Well, it's an honor and a privilege to have Jim Hughes with us this morning to present Creation Ministries. And Jim gave me a short bio of himself so that we can get to know him a little better. So I'll read the words that he gave me on paper here. So James Jim R. Hughes is an elder in the Evangelical Presbyterian Church in Toronto, where he often teaches the adult Sunday school class and provides pulpit supply when the pastor is absent. Jim has eclectic interests, ranging from science and technology to history and theology, and enjoys home construction and renovation projects. He and two of his sons, listen carefully, built and sold a high-end house and gutted and renovated a 100-year-old house in the beaches. Is it sold yet? Okay. He has written extensively, including articles published in several technology journals, an historical romance novel set in Spain during the early Reformation period, is serializing a commentary on Genesis 1 to 11 on his congregation's website, and has published in creation science journals. An examination of the assumptions of Eden's geography erodes flood geology. And he began his career as an urban planner in Sudbury, and most recently was responsible for business analysis and software development methods and tools for a major technology company. He has managed large, complex systems integration and software development projects, and wrote a technology blog on his company's website. He taught statistics for the behavioral sciences at Tyndale University College for 10 years. He also served on the board of the Pregnancy Care Center in Toronto for over 25 years, holding the offices of chairman, treasurer, and secretary. Jim graduated from Harvard University with a BA cum laude, the University of British Columbia, MA, and Ottawa Theological Hall, Diploma of Theology. Jim and his wife, Lillian, live in Scarborough and have 6 children and 10 grandchildren. 10 grandchildren, that's the one that I have to ask you about if it's true. The Lord bless you and keep you.
Let's just bow in prayer for a moment before we begin. Oh God, we do thank you for this, your day, a day that remembers the resurrection on the first day of the week, and in a sense is a day of new creation. We ask, Lord, as we look into the subject of creation, that you would give us wisdom. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Think about the Garden of Eden for a second and tell me what the fundamental battle was that was going on in the Garden of Eden between two things. What was the battle? Good and evil. Truth and error. Falsehood and God's word. Did God really say? Remember those words that Satan said? That's the subject that we're really going to deal with today. Can we trust God's word compared to what Satan would have us believe? So when we look at the view of mankind from the world's perspective, I'd like to give you some examples. Here we have a quotation from Bertrand Russell. Some of you have probably heard of him. He was a philosopher, a pacifist. But he says, man is a curious accident in a backwater. Or Peter Atkins, who was at Oxford, he says, man is just a bit of slime on the planet. Or Stephen Jay Gould, who was a professor at Harvard, he says, man is a fortuitous cosmic afterthought, a tiny little twig on the enormous bush of life. And then we have Richard Dawkins, a well, or a prominent and well-known atheist, neo-atheist, he says, we live in a universe which has no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's the world's thinking about where we stand in the cosmos. When you start on a foundation of evolution, and I'm talking about the philosophical or the perspective, the worldview of evolution. I'm not talking necessarily about individual people who believe in evolution, because some of them may be quite moral. But when you start with a foundation of evolution, everything is based on man's opinion. You have no absolute authority for morality or absolute authority for truth. Everything is relative. And so, as a result, we are seeing, and it's sad to say, in Toronto, we are seeing more and more lawlessness because we are giving up the biblical standard. In contrast, when we start with biblical creation, that foundation, and with God's word, we have standards. Now, you may notice something. Some people may suggest, why didn't I start with God's word in my little chart here rather than with biblical creation? Why do I start the foundation as biblical creation? Anybody want to venture? Why starting with biblical creation? That's exactly what it is. God's created before he communicated. God has said, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then he said something. So he created before he communicated. So we'll start with that order. That's the order God gives us. But in that early part of Genesis, we get a rule of law. Where does law come from in Genesis? Right at the very beginning. There's a rule of law. In the tree, you shall not eat. Right there is a command, rule of law. Where's marriage in the early part of Genesis? Adam and Eve. Right? God brought Eve to him as a helpmeet. There are standards. There's meaning for life. There's purpose in the scriptures. These two worldviews in contrast. Now, when we start with the foundation of biblical creation, because that's where God starts, if we start there and we lay on top of that the Christian worldview, the problem that we often encounter in the church, sad to say, is that people tried to wedge in between biblical creation and Christian worldview, views about evolution, and that the world and the universe are billions of years old. This is what they try to wedge into this perspective. And when this happens, what often occurs is that people begin to leave the church. And why is that? Well, here's an example. And I have many examples. There was a study done by the Pentecostal Assembly of Canada, by the Southern Baptist United States, and so on and so on. When their young people, some of whom may have been in Christian schools, or at least they've had a degree of education in a Christian context, when they go away to university, they see dramatic fall off in terms of church attendance. And this is just one example. This constant brainwashing destroys the faith of many Christians. Our surveys indicate that 80% of first-year students believe in God. I would just correct that. They say they believe in God, who is there, and by their second year, only 15% believe. So something is happening when they are confronted by the world's education system. And the primary reason for this is the questions that they are confronted with in university settings in particular, sometimes in high school settings, and they're not being answered in their churches. Here's a list of examples of the kinds of questions. I'm not going to read them, but they are representative of the types of questions that young people have. Here are a few more. And often the answer that's given is an unsatisfactory answer, and that is, well, I really don't know, but just have faith. That's the answer. But God himself says in Isaiah, come, let's reason together. Paul is one of the most rational, most educated persons in the history of the world, and he presents arguments for why we should believe. Just saying, let's have faith, is not a sufficient answer. So many professing Christians, some of you may even, have some doubts about the reliability of the Bible. You hear it's a constant bombardment of evolutionary thought in our society, and you may have doubts. But it truly is a great time to be a Christian, because the facts that support creation are absolutely overwhelming. When I started getting interested in this subject, I was in high school and I attended Sir John E. MacDonald up on Pharmacy there, south of Finch. And at that time I got a book written, well, it was called The Genesis Flood by Morrison Whitcomb. And I heard Whitcomb speak at the Wishing Well Acres Baptist Church. That's where I heard Whitcomb speak, and I got his book, because it was just down the road on Pharmacy there. That book was seminal, a beginning of a change of tide in the Christian church in terms of how we approach the Genesis flood and creation. But a lot of the material that we have available to us today has only been since about the year 2000. The amount of information supporting creation is absolutely overwhelming. And it truly is a time that we can address and answer the questions satisfactorily, intellectually, rationally, reasonably, and support Scripture. But before we go on, because this is a contrast between evolution and biblical creation, I just want to define evolution, because there are various ways that it can be defined. And so I'm going to give you a definition. I'm not creating a straw man. I will actually quote to you a definition that supports this. But the idea of evolution is that everything that we see around us that is living started from some proto-life forms of chemicals, out of which some original cells evolved. And out of that, genetic complexity has continued to increase through time, until we reach the present where we have all of the variety of life around us. Some of that life has died off in the past. Some of it's in the fossil record. And a lot of the branches, not the nodes, the leaves, but the branches, are the missing links. And evolutionists admit that there are missing links. In fact, you will often see headlines in the news that will say, missing link found. And then if you go back a few weeks later, you'll discover it's not necessarily a missing link. Just to give you an example, many people thought that Neanderthal was a missing link. Today, if you read the scientific literature, you'll see that everybody's come to the conclusion Neanderthal was just a normal human and ate like we do, had religious practices and all the elements of being a human, just as an example. And so we have the views are constantly changing here. Here's a quotation from Lynn Margulis, no longer alive, but he said, every form of life on earth, oak tree and elephant, bird and bacterium, shares a common ancestry. See, starting at that common point with every other form, this fact has been conclusively demonstrated by more than a century of evolutionary research. When this was written and published in Scientific American in the 1970s, it was roughly 120 years since Darwin published his book. And so that's why he says 100 years. But notice he says it is a fact that everything came from a common ancestry. So I gave you that definition of evolution: increasing complexity, the variety of life coming from a single cell. This is not evolution. This is taking a broad genetic spectrum available in the canine genome, out of which wolves, foxes, wolverines, and domestic dogs and coyotes and so on have developed. And out of the family, or the subspecies, if you will, of dog, all of the breeds have developed. And you know that there's a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, and yet they're still dogs. Nobody would say they're anything other than that. That is the genetic variety that's available across the canine genome. Cats, the same thing. Orchids, and so on. But this is not evolution, not increasing complexity, just within the variety of the existing genome. Nor is this evolution. Just recently, a tea plant was found in China that is caffeine-free. I would suggest that you track this and invest in whatever company starts to put this out, because having a naturally decaffeinated tea is going to be a bestseller. Now, how did this develop? Well, when you read on and you discover that there is an enzyme that produces caffeine, and caffeine is a pesticide. By the way, when you drink tea or coffee, you're drinking pesticides. I do like it, caffeinated tea. But the caffeine protects the plant from the insects. Notice that how did it change to be caffeine-free? There is a genetic defect. It lost information and became caffeine-free. That particular plant probably wouldn't survive in the natural environment because it has lost genetic information and cannot protect itself from insects. But notice the article has done a bait and switch. They've put in the word evolution in there when that is not evolution. Losing genetic information is not evolution. And that's how they bait and switch you all the time on this. They will give you examples of genetic variety within a genome or loss of information, like in sickle cell anemia, and claim that it's evolution. The definition of evolution is increasing genetic complexity. What we declare in contrast to this view of evolution is that God created everything in 6 natural days. And he created about 6,000 years ago. At that point, most people's heads explode. When they say, you really believe that the world, the universe is only 6,000 years ago? How can you be so ignorant? And if you read what Richard Dawkins would say, he would call me all kinds of pretty dastardly names because of that view. So what I'd like to do is to give you some reasons why I believe emphatically, based upon Scripture, that God created in 6 natural days about 6,000 years ago. First of all, we'll look at Genesis to history. Second, we're going to consider the fact that death is a result of Adam's sin. And you'll say, what's that got to do with evolution? You will see. Somebody having a motorcycle rally out there, right? Third, I want to just cover some of the things why it's very difficult to explain how all the variety of life we see around us could have come into existence through chance-based processes. Then I just want to give you some brief overview on why the world can't be billions of years old. I'm not going to consider the universe, which they claim is 13.8 billion years old. I'm just going to look at the world, which they claim is 4.5 billion years. And finally, just some facts to support the biblical flood. Now, on each of these topics, well, not on topic 2, but on the others, I have much more detailed presentations. And given that I'm just down the road, literally 4 minutes from here is where I live, if you ever wanted me to come back and do more detailed presentations, I could, because I have a dozen presentations in lots of depth on different topics. But we're just going to cover the very top level, a little bit on each topic. And just so you know, you'll be watching the green, yellow, orange, blue, and red arrows go by. When you get to the blue, you'll say, oh boy, he's almost done. When you get to the red, you'll know we're in the last topic. So we'll start off with Genesis is history. We have 2 sequences that are presented to us. The evolutionary sequence is on the left, which I won't go into in detail, but if you read any in the scientific literature that supports evolution, you will see that this sequence is necessary and part of their model. On the right is taking out the pieces directly from Genesis chapter 1 in the order in which God presents them. You will see that those 2 sequences are different, and for all of the attempts of some Christians who would attempt to synchronize these 2 sequences and say, well, we can bring them together, it's not possible. These 2 sequences are so discordant. And we have a basic rule of logic, which is called the law of non-contradiction. When 2 things contradict one another, at least one of them must be wrong. So the question is, which one of these sequences is wrong? So we're going to look at the Genesis sequence first of all. In Genesis chapter 1, the narrative is presented as a historical text. It is the natural reading of the text. A study was done by a man named Stephen Boyd, who has his doctorate in Hebrew, and he compared the verb forms that are used in Genesis 1. Sorry, let me back up. He compared the verb forms that are used in historical narrative, say the Book of Kings, Book of Samuel, in historical narrative, with the verb forms that are used in poetry, like the Psalms. Compared those. Then he saw the different verb forms, and then he took Genesis 1 and he compared it to those two different verb forms. And overwhelmingly, way off the statistical charts, the verb forms that are used in Genesis 1 are historical verb forms, not poetic verb forms. So Genesis 1 is presented to be read as a historical narrative. It's also given in the form of a chronology. You can think, we don't see it so much in English as it is in the original Hebrew and in the Hebrew mindset. When you wanted to give the idea of something being very consecutive, you presented it with, and God did this, and God did this, and God did this, right? And it's a sequence, it's a narrative. And that's how it's presented. And we read that God created these things by speaking and they came into existence. Now, God could have created the entire universe instantaneously. He could have done that. And I am absolutely convinced that when Jesus returns, he's going to recreate the universe instantaneously. But why did God do this in 6 days? Not because he got tired, but to set a pattern for man's work week. And then we have this consecutive, and God said. And this has a technical term, but it's a consecutive construct. You can go to the Gospel of Mark. Now, if you can read Greek, but you don't see it again so much in English, but in the Gospel of Mark, the writer with a Hebrew mindset, and Jesus did this, and Jesus said this, and the and occurs over and over again. And the same thing if you go to the Old King James. In the book of Revelation, John does the same thing. The and is all over the place. I remember when I was in high school, and I started a number of sentences in an essay with and. And my high school teacher, English teacher, said, oh, we don't start sentences with and. I opened up the book of Revelation in the King James, and I showed it to her. We don't. Of course, she didn't believe the Bible, but King James is a good standard in English, right? So, but we don't, today we use now and then and other things like that to modify because it gets a little tedious. There's also in Genesis 1 the ordinal. There was evening and there was morning the first day. There was evening and morning the second day. Well, if you compare that usage to Numbers 7 and Numbers 29 when the sacrifices were being brought, you will see that that structure indicates daily activity. So we should be consistent in Genesis 1. And each of the days is declared to us to have an evening and a morning. Now we would say morning and evening, but it's the same construct. The interesting thing is, how else could God communicate to us that he created in 6 natural days? God couldn't say it. On the day one in the first 24 hours. Why? Because the construct of 24 hours is a human invention that occurred after the flood. Some people say it came out of Egypt, some out of Sumeria, some out of Babylon, but 24 hours. Why 24 hours in a day? It's meaningless. Do you know during the French Revolution they tried to put 10-hour days together with 100 minutes in an hour? That's what they attempted to do. Wasn't very successful. But and if you go to Swatch, which is the Swiss watch company's website, they're trying to introduce a metric time system. So 24 hours is somewhat arbitrary. How else could God communicate to us that he created in natural days other than saying there was evening and there was morning? They're natural days. And in Exodus 20, when God gives the Ten Commandments, he uses the construct of, for in 6 days God created, as the justification for man's working 6 days and resting on a seventh. Now, if God didn't create in 6 days, then the analogy falls apart. And God is actually lying when he's giving the Ten Commandments to Moses. And then we have the Jesus saying that at the beginning, when man was created, well, if man came along 13.8 billion years after the beginning, then Jesus isn't telling the truth. Now, yes, Adam came on the sixth day of creation, but in relative terms, it's the beginning, isn't it? And then the rest of the Bible overwhelmingly treats Genesis 1 as history. And I just have a few examples here. Psalm 104 and what Paul says in Corinthians and so on. So, point number one, why we accept Genesis 1 as a historical narrative. We don't try to force it into a framework hypothesis or a day-age view or any of those kinds of things. We just accept what God said. As our pastor often says, read what's on the page. And that's what God says. Second argument for why we accept the creation account the way it is that death is a result of Adam's sin. It's not a natural process. And so death of living creatures, which in the Hebrew is nefesh chaya, when the death of the living creature is, and why I say that is there are certain components of life that are not necessarily life that we're talking about. For example, Adam was expected to take care of things in the garden, maybe to prune the trees because they would grow. Those tree branches may have decomposed into fertilizer again. That isn't necessarily death. It's more like the hydrologic cycle. So we got to be careful here. But we're talking about living creatures that have the breath of life in them. That's what the Hebrew term means. That death is introduced by Adam's sin into the world. Man and animals like cats and dogs and cattle and so on. And at the end of the creation week, God saw everything that he had made. And he declared it to be very good. But if there have been millions and millions of years of evolution before Adam came along, or before God took a primate of some sort and breathed into it a rational soul, then what we have is death and decay and suffering and disease, all of which are recorded in the fossil record. There are examples of cancer and rickets and carnivorism, all in the fossil record. And this is what God is declaring to be very good? What a contradiction. Every single... Sorry, I should just make the point that flashed up there. Adam's sin introduced death into the world. And every single fossil must be after Adam's sin. That doesn't mean that they were all created during the flood. Some could have been created after. But every fossil must be the result of Adam's sin. And so Paul also sets up an interesting analogy. He says, for in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive. If there wasn't a historical Adam who brought sin into the world that introduced death and decay into the world, then his analogy falls apart because there isn't a historical Christ who brought life through his resurrection and made us alive. You can't have one without the other. There has to have been a historical Adam. Third reason why we accept the Genesis account as the way God has communicated, as speaking of a history and not evolutionary, is it's difficult to explain chance-based processes. Now, I can't go into today, I have a couple of presentations in detail with evolution, but I'm just going to look at a few things. We won't start with organic chemistry, we'll just come up to the level and we'll start with the DNA molecules. DNA molecules are extremely complex. In the 1950s, Stanley Miller put together an experiment trying to simulate what he believed at the time, which has completely changed now in scientific thinking, but what he believed at the time was how the original Earth's atmosphere was, and he put into that collection of chemicals a spark, as if it was lightning, to see if he could generate some components of life. And what it generated, according to Scientific American, was four amino acids that are constituents of tar. That's what it generated. Since then, many experiments have been conducted and documented in the literature attempting to generate the, at minimum, a self-replicating molecule. Not DNA, just a self-replicating molecule, and they have not been successful. In fact, the amount of intelligence in laboratory space and money that has gone into this indicates that life is a product of intelligence, not of chance. And so the genetic code, DNA, and I might pause here for a moment, because when Darwin wrote his book, The Origin of Species, in the 1850s, there were information that he had no clue about. He didn't know anything about genetics. Mendel was working about the same time and published at the same time, but Darwin didn't know anything about genetics. Darwin didn't know anything about the complexity of the cell. The view of a cell at that time was it was basically a gelatin mass. And he knew nothing about DNA. DNA was discovered in the 1950s, 100 years after Darwin. So this is a real problem for Darwinian evolutionary thinking, because Darwin knew nothing about the complexity of life. And the thing is that DNA is not hardware, it is software. It is the information. Think of it like alphabet soup. The hardware are the letters, and you can assemble those into words. You don't normally see words, certainly maybe three letters come together, but you don't see whole sentences assembling in your alphabet soup. DNA is an assembly of information using the hardware that underlies it, the chemical proteins that make it up. So even if the hardware could be generated by chance, just assemble some of these chemical components together, the information that's built into DNA is a whole order of magnitude more complex than the hardware. And there's an article by a physicist writing in the Guardian. He said, how did nature fabricate the world's first digital information processor, the original living cell, from the blind chaos of blundering molecules? How did molecular hardware get to write its own software? Put this into perspective. Most of you have a cell phone, smartphone, or a computer. I would challenge you, in fact, I'd be willing to bet you $1 million that you're not going to come to me tomorrow and say, oh, my cell phone wrote its own app. It just doesn't happen. We know that. The complexity of DNA is mind-boggling. And everything I'm going to present to you now has been discovered in the last 20 years. In the last 20 years about DNA. First of all, the information in DNA can be read bidirectionally. You read it one way, you get a set of instructions. You read it the other way, you get a set of instructions. Think about this. How many of you could write a palindrome like Badam, I'm Adam, or Ere I saw Elba? How does it go? Abel was I before I saw Elba. Those are palindromes. You can read them either direction. DNA can be read in both directions. It's mind-boggling. We couldn't even conceive of doing something that complex. You can start at different points in the DNA chain, and you get a different set of instructions for different things. You can take words of a certain set of the four letters that make them up, and take words here, or start here, or start here, and you get different sets of instructions. You get switches that can be toggled on and off through what's called epigenetic information. Outside of the gene, certain signals can come in, and I'll give you an example of that later, that tell cells to do different things and toggle switches on and off, and DNA will do different things. There's so much more complexity there that it is, what was the song we were singing there about the wonder of creation? We should add DNA in there, shouldn't we? Into that example. It is, if there's anything anything in the world that says made by God, it's DNA. And none of the stuff I just presented to you was known 20 years ago. It's mind-boggling. So let's bring it up a level. And I'm skipping all kinds of complexities in here. But how did DNA in a cell, and we have both cells that do not have nuclei and cells that are nucleated, how did non-nucleated cells become nucleated? Now, there are various theories. Well, one cell captured another cell, for example. We are made up of cells that have nuclei in them. Or take it up a level. How did single-celled entities begin to cooperate to create multi-celled entities? And here is an example. You take a cell, I'm sure some of you have heard of stem cells. You take a stem cell, and out of stem cells, with signals that are in the forming body, or in our own living body now, like adult bodies or grown-up bodies, signals are communicated to the stem cells, and they say, oh, by the way, I need an ear cell over here, or I need a liver cell over here. How did these cells start to learn to communicate and cooperate and start to work together to form a multicellular entity? Take it up a level. So yes, you have cells with nuclei in them, and if you remember your high school science, an amoeba it would clone its chromosomes, and then it would split, and you'd have basically identical copies of it. How did those single-cell entities begin to work together to do bisexual reproduction, to take two different sets of chromosomes and bring them together to make a new entity? And even if it were possible for a new type of life to suddenly appear through a fortuitous chance event that allowed it to survive. So let's say this new creature, we'll call it XYZ, came into existence, and it was a male, somewhere at the same time in the same place, there has to be an XYZ that's a female, or there's no reproduction. How did this happen? Darwin said, if it could be demonstrated any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Some of you may have heard of a scientist at Lehigh University wrote Darwin's Black Box. Behe wrote Darwin's Black Box. I'm not recommending you buy his book, by the way. He has a lot of good things to say about molecular structures, but he is a theistic evolutionist. But 25 years ago, he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. And he challenged this exact statement right here of Darwin. And he says, I'll show you complex molecular structures that could never have occurred by chance. And in his book, he uses an example of a mouse trap, which has various components, and he calls it irreducible complexity. You have to have all the components of the mousetrap or it won't work. It just won't work. Well, he just came out with a new book in October called Darwin Devolves. And basically, he's looked at the past 20 years of scientific literature and attempts to discredit his book, Darwin's Black Box, and he shows that nothing has changed. There is nothing addressing the complexity of life in the scientific literature. Again, I'm not recommending Darwin's Black Box. In fact, I wrote a review of that book, and it was published in the Creation Science Quarterly, just the last issue. So I don't recommend the book. But the ideas he has are valuable in terms of the complexity, challenging Darwin. Just think of some of the things that evolutionists will tell you. Assume for a moment that they're correct, that birds evolved from either dinosaurs or reptiles. Just make the assumption that they're correct on it, which I don't agree with. But how did the reptilian or dinosaur-like lung evolve into a bird lung? Or how did fish become amphibians become reptiles, and reptiles become mammalian or birds? How did their eggs go through that evolutionary process? They're completely different entities. Feathers, How could reptilian scales evolve into feathers made of completely different substances? Of course, I just have to throw in the woodpecker. How did the woodpecker learn to bang its head against a tree and not get a headache? You know, just it's mind-boggling. You can take Darwin. So take it up a level to symbiotic relationships. Anybody grow tomatoes in the garden? Anybody who grow tomatoes? Yeah. Do you know how tomatoes are fertilized? You do them by hand? Oh. Tomatoes are interesting. They can be fertilized by, you're thinking putting nutrients on, but I'm talking about pollen. Sort of, but the tomatoes require the bumblebees. If you don't have bumblebees, you won't get fertilized tomatoes. Anybody know why that is? It's really cool. Really cool. Symbiotic relationship. Bumblebees hum at middle C. And when the tomato plant hears the bumblebees hum, they open up for fertilization. Regular bees don't hum while they work. Bumblebees hum while they work. And if you don't have bumblebees, occasionally a little bit of wind will pollinate, or you can go out with a Q-tip and do a hand pollination. But bumblebees, symbiotic relationships, there are hundreds, thousands of them in the natural realm. Evolution cannot explain how these came into existence. Let's take up one more level. And again, I'm being very high level here in terms of a survey. And it's the origin of human language. Languages themselves are extremely complex structures. And the interesting thing is that the complexity of languages through time has been decreasing, not increasing. Older languages are much more complex. People say, well, English is a complex language. But we don't have the various verb forms and all of the declensions and conjugations that you would say have in French or in Latin. You go back further into Greek, and you'll find it's an older language, and you will find that it's more complex. You go, I missed Latin in there. You go back to Latin, it's more complex. Go back to Greek. Go back to Sanskrit, which is even older in the Indo-European languages. A family of languages, and languages are not evolving in complexity, they're devolving. They're getting simpler in their structures. Just to give you one example, one of my daughters lives in Quebec City and she teaches English at the oldest elementary school in North America. It's been going since the 1600s, it's right in downtown Quebec, city of Quebec. And she's had an English program. It was founded by the Ursuline sisters. But one of her kids asked her, how come in English we don't have the formal and the informal like they do in French, the tu and the vous? Well, we used to in English. We used to have thou and thee and you, but it's all been, coincidentally, we've all gone with the more formal, because the thou and the thee used to be the colloquial, and we've gone with the formal. So English has gotten simplified, as an example. There's also been a common vocabulary decline. At the time of Shakespeare, it is estimated that the average person, think about this, the average person knew 60,000 words. Do you know how many words the average person today knows? About 15,000. And I think the average teenager knows about 100. So, sorry, guys. The idea originally was, there was a lot of research done from about the middle of the 18th century up until probably the end of the 19th century, people trying to find the common origin of languages. And they used to present something like this, where you had a tree in all the languages, and there would have been this common proto-language. The interesting thing, if you tried to go and do it in a linguistics program today and said, my doctoral thesis I want to pursue is on finding the common original proto-language from which all languages developed, no university will even entertain it anymore. They've given up on it, and instead, what they talk about are the bushes because there are over 50 distinct language families in the world, and there probably are more because some have gone extinct, but there are, and there's no common origin of language. Well, the interesting thing is, all of these languages that, or the original language like this Hebrew and its cognates or so on, they all seem to suddenly appear in historical records around 2200 BC. Sumerian, Egyptian, the Aramaic and its cognates, Hebrew and Akkadian and so on. You'll see these all coming into existence. Well, we know where they came from, don't we? Genesis chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. Of course, it's rejected out of hand in the academic community. Human language actually confirms the biblical count, and it's contrary to evolution. Fourth point I want to make is that the earth is, see we're at the blue? There's blue and the red, and we're almost done. The earth is not billions of years old. Give you an example here. Mitochondria is part of the cell that it powerhouses. It takes energy that we eat in food and it converts it into energy that our cells can use. You know how at the Beck Generating Plant there in Niagara Falls, water falling, one form of energy, turns into electricity, another form of energy. Well, that's what mitochondria do. Mitochondria, up until a few months ago, everybody believed that mitochondria was always, the DNA of mitochondria was only inherited from our mothers. There was a study just recently published that there may be some evidence that we get some of our mitochondria DNA from our fathers. But the interesting thing is that genetically, in our mitochondria, we are all very, very similar. There's more variety in the rest of the genome, things like hair color and skin color and eye color and all those kinds of height and so on. But in our mitochondria DNA, there's very, very little differentiation amongst all humankind. But there has been some changes through time. And so some studies have been done, and they were based on the Russian Romanov family and on descendants of that family and descendants of Civil War, individuals that fought during the Civil War. So you can picture a Romanov princess in the 1800s and somebody preserved her comb and there's a piece of hair in it and we have a DNA sample and we know who her descendants are and we can compare the mitochondria DNA of those two individuals or collections of. Similarly, a mother kept a hair sample of her son before he went off to fight in the American Civil War, and it was in an envelope, and it says Johnny's hair, and we know whose Johnny's descendants are. Obviously, he wasn't killed during the Civil War. So we have that. So they've taken this information, and Ann Gibbons, who published this article, she said evolutionary studies led them to expect about one mutation in mitochondria DNA every 12,000 years. And they were absolutely stunned to find that there were 40, to find 10 base pair changes, which gave them a rate of one mutation every 40 generations, or one every 800 years instead of 12,000 years. The problem from an evolutionary perspective is that mitochondria DNA has been changing too fast. If humans have been on the earth, say, first hominoids 1.2 million years ago, first Homo sapiens 200,000 years ago, mitochondria DNA is changing too fast. There should be a lot more changes in the human genome in the mitochondria DNA. And what's interesting, Ann Gibbons says that the measured rate indicates that mankind has only been around for 6,000 years. Hello? That's what I said at the very beginning. Six natural days, 6,000 years ago. Well, do you know what Ann Gibbons says in the article? She says, but nobody believes that that's the case. And yet the scientific evidence is supporting the biblical account. Another recent one, genome decay. Professor at Cornell, I have his book out there actually, on this, if you're interested. Professor at Cornell University, later in life, he became a Christian. He is one of the world's leading geneticists. He has more patents, I believe, than any other geneticist. His name is Sanford. He after becoming a Christian, he started to re-examine his worldview and thinking. And what he determined was that mutations are overwhelmingly negative. And each generation is accumulating more and more genetic diseases. Any idea how many genetic diseases in the human population? Rough guess? 1,000. That is actually pretty, almost like perfect on. It's about 1,000 genetic diseases in the human population. And every generation is adding roughly between 100 and 300 additional genetic defects. So when you go home and you're sitting around your table and you have kids at your table, you can call them mutants, because they're more mutated than you are. So, in fact, one of the things that, from my perspective, I believe that why, do you remember Adam and Eve? Well, Cain had a wife, and one of the questions is, well, where did Cain get his wife? Well, he either married one of his sisters, or he married one of his nieces. He had to, because all of the descendants came from Adam. And prior to the time of Moses, brother-sister incest was not an issue. Abraham married his half-sister. Remember Sarah? Just as an example, brother-sister, we cringe at the thought of brother-sister incest, don't we? Marry my brother? You've got to be kidding, right? That kind of thing. But at the time of Moses, in Leviticus 18, God introduces a whole new set of consanguinity guidelines or rules, because the genome is decaying and genetic diseases are increasing. And he introduces that, I believe, partly, at least partly, to protect the human race. So we have these, Sanford predicts that they are going to destroy the human population in roughly 300 generations. Roughly 300. Any idea how far we are into the scheme? We're roughly 200 generations. So we still have a few generations before monsters are being produced, and we can't, as a population, cannot reproduce. The human population hasn't been around for millions of years. It's an impossibility with the introduction of the genome decay. Here's another example. Again, recent stuff. When, who was it? Schweitzer. Trying to find her name here if I have it. No, Mary Schweitzer. There it is. It's in the note. She published taking dinosaur bones, and in it she found soft tissue, blood cells, and DNA, and so on. And she published this article in the Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute, the museum in Washington, D.C., amongst others. And she was ridiculed for this. She's not a believer. She's not a creationist. But she says, I'm just presenting what I saw. And they gave all kinds of counter-explanations. Since then, there have been at least 40 additional finds. In fact, some people have described going out to Alberta and opening up some of the fossils there, and when they open the fossil burial grounds, and when they open them up, they smell death. It hasn't decayed yet. And so we have a situation here where the Earth and these fossils could not have been buried 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs were supposed to have been obliterated, because the soft tissue would have long ago decayed. You know, in fact, I had this experience with my daughter. I'll explain in a second, my daughter who's out there. But you know that there's something common in your medicine cabinet, your refrigerator, and in your pantry. The products all generally have a best before life. Right? We know the organic material decays. Well, we had this experience at our church. My daughter, on one day a week, she goes and she acts as a janitor of the church. And we were putting soft soap in those, you know, things you call them dispensers, you know, on the wall. And it turned out the soft soap was going bad because we don't use it fast enough. Now, I had no clue that soft soap would go bad. Have you looked at it? There's a little label on your soft soap, and it'll say 18. An 18 or a 12 on it, well, it's made out of fats, and it goes rancid. I didn't even think about that. So we had to clean out all the containers, and I've had to find something that wouldn't decay. So we know organic materials decay, or at least we should. And this is, so this is recent scientific discoveries that validate that the world isn't billions of years old. Another, just a simple one, oil and gas is under pressure. The pressure would have long ago dissipated if it was buried millions and millions of years ago. And one last example. The Earth is a gigantic magnet. And again, this is recent stuff that was studies that were done. Taking artifacts like from archaeology from the time of the Vikings and their iron implements, and you can get the magnetic moment on them and compare them where we are today. The Earth's magnetic field is declining, and you can calculate a decay curve on it based upon comparing 1000 AD to the present. And if you extrapolate and assume a constant decay curve to about 10,000 years into the past, the Earth would be so magnetic it would be molten. If you extrapolate into the future, in about 1,000 years, the magnetic field is going to completely disappear, and we will all be fried to death because the Earth's magnetosphere protects us from cosmic rays. So you have your choice. You can either boil to death or fry to death. But there's no way that the world is billions of years old. Now, evolutionists have countered and say, well, the magnetic field flips. It may flip, but that doesn't mean it regenerates. And they have no evidence of it regenerating. It's their hope. So again, I can go into a lot more detail on this, but I can't today. The Earth isn't really very old. It's just tired. As Paul says in Romans, the Earth is groaning in its decay as a result of Adam's sin, waiting for its redemption and recreation. And since the Earth isn't really old, there isn't enough time for evolution. And then our last survey here is some facts to support the biblical account of the flood. Mass extinctions, huge quantities of fossils, and sediment layers that go worldwide, same sediment layers in Brazil as in Africa. Some point those continents were connected up. And we believe in Creation Ministries International that originally one single continent. During the flood, it was covered with sediment, and then it started to break up during the flood, later stages, after about day 150 or thereabouts. The runoff to the Grand Canyon was not carved by the Colorado River. The Colorado River follows the canyon. There was originally what is today North America was covered by massive amounts of sediment that was still very soft. And as the water was beginning to run off into the new forming ocean basins, the Earth originally had shallow seas, but as the aquifers out of which the fountains of the deep exploded, those aquifers collapsed, part of an tectonic shifts creating new deep oceans. All that water is rushing off, and it's creating the Grand Canyon. Here's a micro example that validates the biblical model. In 1980, when Mount St. Helens exploded, massive amounts of hot water and sludge and mud came washing down, and within 5 years, and it formed these sediment layers extremely rapidly, and within 5 years they were forming into rock. Small scale, but it demonstrates the flood. Rapid sediment deposition, ripple marks, footprints, and raindrops. These sediment layers had to be laid down in rapid succession on top of one another through what's called planar flow. Creatures that are completely covered in sediment rapidly. For instance, this is a dolphin, probably a dolphin, dolphin-like creature, and it's actually giving birth, and it's captured in the sediment layer. And you look at the Grand Canyon. The rows of sediment are absolutely razor sharp. Where is, if millions of years have transpired, where's soil formation? Where is erosion? These layers were laid down extremely fast. Tree trunks that go through multiple layers of sediment. You might have a shale and then a coal layer and then a sandstone layer and so on. And there are at least 50 of these forests around the world that have been buried this way with their tree trunks going through multiple sediment layers. These could not have been laid down over millions of years. The tree trunks would have eroded away. Geologists have to admit that this is catastrophic, but they say it's always local catastrophes. Soft sediment deformation. Rock does not bend, it cracks. But right after the flood, the sediment layers were soft, the new continents were being formed. India smashes into Asia, and the Himalayas are forced up really rapidly. Water gaps run off through planar flow, and so on. All of this is overwhelming evidence of the flood, and not over millions of years. And so biblical creation and the Genesis account is a historical account, and it's a good statement of history that is supported by the facts. And what does Peter tell us? That we have to be in our hearts prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks us for the reason. So this goes back to the original statements I made about questions that we're going to be asked. We better be able to answer them. Now, you don't have to be a scientist, and you're going to need help on this. But are you ready to give a defense for why you would believe in biblical creation and not just say, accept it on faith, or don't say, well, just because God said so? So, first clipboards go around. We have, yes, go ahead and hand them out. We have every Friday it comes out, it's called Info Bytes. And every Friday you'll get something useful out of it. So I'd recommend if you have an email address and you're not subscribing to Info Bytes, sign up for it. Because we send out every Friday updates. Very helpful. I really enjoy getting it. Here was one example, like what caused the Ice Age and so on. So fill in your email address and at the end give them to me or to Jennifer and we'll get them, you added to the mailing list. We have all kinds of material out here on the table. Why do you have to study for exams? Anybody know why you have to study for exam? Because even after you've taken a course, you forget it, right? And you have to study and cram the night before. Well, some of you may not have studied at all, and that's why you have to study for exam. But even if you've sat through the lectures, you have to refresh yourself. Well, I can guarantee you that you'll walk out of here and you'll say, well, that was sort of interesting. I meet you in a week, you'll barely remember what I talk about. If I come back in 3 months, it'll just be a fuzz. So what I'm doing here is I'm not really educating you. I'm trying to whet your appetite to go in more detail. And so we have the faith building pack. If you are interested in apologetics or you have a non-Christian friend, you're talking Christianity with, this is a good one, Christianity for Skeptics. And then we have our Creation's Answers book that's gone through a number of editions and we've refined it. And it answers all those questions I'd put up earlier and it answers about 66 questions, I believe. We have one written by our PhD scientists in the area of discipline on problems with evolution. We have an accompanying DVD. We have a commentary written by one of our scientists and on Genesis 1 to 11, and I have copies of it here. We have a big bundle of them. If you're a real keener, you can get a complete set of material, and you'll get like $330 worth for $199. Creation Magazine, let's hand around the next clipboard. This is our primary tool. It comes out quarterly. I'll just give you two quick stories on how we use it. People can use it in our congregation. There's a woman who's, and her husband, but Aries' dad is 100 years old and he's blind. And Marianne takes Creation Magazine to him. He enjoys it, but he can't read it. So he has his unbelieving children read it to him as an evangelistic tool. And they do. They accommodate him. And one of my grandsons who lives in Quebec City, he has a subscription to this. He takes it to school with him. So, as an evangelistic tool. There are many articles in Creation Magazine. It comes out quarterly. And you can subscribe today. If you subscribe today, tear off the bottom one, fill in both sides of the form, and when you give it to Jennifer or to me, what you will get is a free DVD right now and a free copy of it. And we only charge you charge quarterly. I think it's $7.50 a quarter, and we don't charge you for a year. You can do it if you want, but it's only quarterly and you can cancel any time. But it's a very valuable tool. We have children's packs out there of books. Brand new one that's just come out. And, of course, I recommend this because it's written by Aaron Hughes. And I like the name Hughes, given that's my last name. But Aaron is a good writer, by the way. I enjoy her writing. And she writes on our website quite a bit. This one is a Creation's Answer for Kid, and I have copies of it. We have the DVD Explorer pack. I don't have any copies of the Genesis Academy with me. It'll come in my next top-up for my home inventory, but we've just come out with the Genesis Academy, and it's a study guide for, like, you could use it in Bible study, midweek meetings, that kind of thing, and it's available. I don't have any copies, but you can get it off our website. We also have, last time I looked, we have over 13,000 articles on our website. If you're too cheap to buy anything, you can get most of it for free on our website. We update it regularly. And we have an events calendar. In fact, I was speaking to one gentleman where you saw on our website today, or to come here today from the website. And there's all kinds of videos are available. By the way, within Creation Ministries International, the Journal of Creation and Creation Magazine are published out of Australia. The website is managed out of the U.S. And all of the video work is done in Kitchener for all of CMI. So we split up it, and we have a tremendously good studio in Kitchener, and you can watch these videos. Sad to say, in Canada, broadcasting is very difficult, Christian broadcasting, because of CRTC regulations, but you can get a lot of the material. And so just to wrap up, please get some of that material. Take advantage of it, because you're not going to remember the details that I put here unless you've got a photographic memory. So why is the church ineffective today in so many ways, and why is it being marginalized? One of the reasons is because the church is actually fighting within itself about the creation account. And I just refer you to Acts 17, where Paul, when he goes into the Areopagus, to Mars Hill, how does he present the gospel? He starts with God, who was the creator. That's where he starts. And that's what we need to be doing in the church. Because if people do not come to the knowledge of God as creator, then they're not going to accept God's standards, and they're not going to accept God's salvation. We need to stop fighting within the church, and we need to be aiming our intellectual guns at evolution. And we need to get this kind of material into our church libraries, into our families, into our grandchildren, or wherever it is, and we need to make it available. So we'll wrap up. For now, I believe that at some point we're going to have a Q&A. Maybe the pastor can mention what the schedule is. And do you want to close in prayer?
Sure. Yes.
But we are going to have a Q&A at some point.